Welcome to Accessibility Ally. It's a podcast featuring guests with a range of disabilities and social identities. They share provocative ideas and challenge allies to disrupt ableism. And I'm your host, Corey Melanson. Thanks for tuning in. In this first episode of Accessibility Ally, we talk with Paul Tingley, who has personal and professional connections to accessibility. We set the stage for the podcast series in talking about some of the highlights of accessibility work that's happening in Nova Scotia, as well as some of the challenges in how this work is rolling out. We know that there's a goal to be accessible by 2030 in Nova Scotia, and Paul brings his perspective as someone who's worked in community, someone who works in the public sector, and someone who supports businesses in their journey to take action and learn more about accessibility. Tune in to learn about disability, accessibility, allyship, where we've come from in Nova Scotia, and where we're headed to be accessible by 2030. So how are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing great, thanks. A little chilly out there, but all is good.
So Paul, this is really bad. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's your last name?
Tingley.
Yes, and I knew that. Like it's I looked start, at it this Corey. Morning. I know it's a really, really good start. I didn't print my anyway. So really happy today to be joined by Paul Tingley. And Paul, could you please introduce yourself and just share your personal and your professional connections to accessibility?
Yes, of course. First, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and help spread the good word about accessibility and where we're going as society. But for me, what brought me into this was kind of a ski accident. About 30 years ago, I had a spinal cord injury, left me paralyzed. And after that, I was 24 years old and that was a new beginning for me. And that really started my journey into having a disability, learning about accessibility, barriers, such and so forth. But I got into sports after that, all the different para sports. I went to a couple Paralympics. I chose sailing as my sport.
Amazing. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I went to five Paralympic games.
Okay.
Did a bunch of sailing, got my 10,000 hours in on the boats and stuff, feeling free out on the water. And then after I retired after 2016, I got a job with Sport Nova Scotia as a parasport coordinator. So I was able to help build those opportunities for other people around. And I learned a lot about the evolution of where we are right now and what change is possible and why people don't change, I guess. And so then after I did parasport for 5 years, I got a job with the province and I was a recreation consultant and it was a designated position. So I was able to get in there. It's very hard to get into government sometimes, but
it is.
I was very happy to be a rec consultant. And then after a year of that, I moved into the program officer for the accessibility programs. So yeah. We give out $1 million to community groups and $1 million to businesses each year to reduce barriers.
So many questions from just that that introduction. So thanks so much for introducing yourself and telling us a bit about your story. So I guess first to follow up, just what are some of those programs that businesses do, but also that community is focused on?
So we have an intake February 14th, and we have an application, why businesses want to become accessible for whatever reasons. There are costs associated, usually, whether it's the built environment, communications, transportation. So what the government does is they'll pay 2/3 of that expense. And it's after a bit of a process to make sure that they're eligible, good standing, and that they have the capacity to do good quality work. And we are oversubscribed 3 times as busy. We have $3 million in asks for the $1 million available with community.
Okay.
And the business is about the right, $1 million applies. So we are lucky enough. This is the 8th year we've been doing this. And we've funded hundreds of projects. So think of all those barriers that are being removed through this program. And it's great. It's just getting the word out there. And I think it could grow and really be a lever, a way for Nova Scotia to become accessible. This is one of the ways.
Yeah. And certainly I'm curious about the difference between like our community organizations doing similar things to businesses. Is it about built environment and communications? Yep.
It's close. There's the six standards, which there's legislation 2030, but we call them categories. So with the business, we have five categories. They don't exactly all line up with the standards, but they're very similar. And one of them is called Universal Design Capacity Development. So that one is really the most exciting for me because it usually a lot of them is the built environment, a lot of ramps, entrances, bathrooms. That's probably like 80% of our asks. But then you get these projects come along and they try to do wide scale, like industry leaders, like the Restaurant Association or the Realtors Association in Nova Scotia. They're trying to like look at what they offer and make it accessible to all. So that was the business with five categories. And then the community, we are calling it accessibility improvements. It's so complicated how, where people are in their journey, what they're looking at what's in front of them, what's being asked, and then they want to do better. So we consider all these asks. So we don't want to start pigeonholing into like buckets. If it falls out of the bucket and it's still a good project, well, we want to consider that.
Right. And I mean, it's really exciting to hear that there's funding, there's resources. And I know we will be, and we are talking about the accessibility standards in some other podcasts. So I know we don't have to go into lots of detail, but certainly Nova Scotia has a goal to be accessible by 2030. And the way the government is doing that is through those six standards. And I believe built environment will be enacted this year, and then education and
transportation is the next one.
Thank you. Yeah. So what's interesting is it seems like there's a lot of interest from community and business kind of even before those standards are enacted. Mm-hmm. Do you think, is that because they know they're coming? Is that because people just understand that there's sort of a moral obligation or that there's economic benefit? Like what do you think is the motivation for businesses and community organizations to kind of reach out for this funding?
Yeah, I think it's everything. You know, there's people that will do it because it's the right thing to do. It's the human rights. You just want to make it a better society, removing barriers for everybody. They have empathy. They can see other people in the struggles, and through a little bit of effort on their own, they can remove those barriers. Then there's the legal, which is legislation that's coming. So really, like, you've got the moral, and then you have like the education of why this is good. And it can be very good for businesses. It's going to get more people involved. It's better to have a diverse society. It's going to be stronger, more resilient. So it's really hard to know what their motivations are. Like, we have the carrot and the stick. The carrot would be the education. You just realize this is the right thing to do. And some people, they just won't see it. They don't know what they don't know. And it won't be until maybe there's got to be fines or something like that. And that will kind of shake them into action. But I think there's a lot of good reasons. Whatever it is, we just try to make it easier for them and for it to happen.
Yeah, that's so great. So what does accessibility mean to you? Again, sort of personally and professionally.
Well, I had my accident 30 years ago, and I remember when accessibility was our word for people with disabilities. It meant like wheelchair accessibility, because I'm just being selfish, I guess, thinking about myself. But it was always like, is that accessible? And but then in the last 10 years, I think society has used it for, you know, general public access to goods and services programs, places. And it's all about like accessible, meaning like the location or the cost or the time of day. Is it like on the web? Is it accessible? Can you see it? So really, accessibility used to mean like wheelchair accessibility, removing barriers. But now I think it's more of a societal word. But really, all it is kind of like removing barriers for all different groups. So everyone's got different impairments or disabilities or not, and kind of building that space or program with the barriers removed, and that's going to be accessible.
Yeah, and we talk a fair bit in this podcast about how there are 2 in 5 Nova Scotians who have a disability, and knowing that those are physical, those are invisible, those are mental, like so many different kinds of disabilities, and knowing that those numbers have gone up in the last kind of 5 or 6 years and likely will continue to rise. Mm-hmm. And I mean, sometimes people ask me the question, like, why does Nova Scotia have the highest rates in the country? And I honestly can't answer that, but
I was like, over to you,
Paul.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I know.
I'm looking at someone. No, there's no one else here. But it is very interesting. I don't know why it is. I have no idea. We're above the national average and definitely above the world's population of, but like how you define it. And so you kind of, you self-proclaim yourself as like having a disability, where in some other places it might be a medical note and things like that. So mm-hmm. I think that would be a reason why Canada has more than the rest, I would say. But I think, yeah, we're probably the same as every other society around the world kind of thing, more or less. But
and then I wonder, like Nova Scotia, I guess we might have more of an aging population. And of course, like the idea that we all will have a disability at some point in our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, even my own journey in the last couple of years has just like, I had a brain injury and how that impacted my life. And then just some of the barriers that I faced and continue some of those like flexibility and things that I continue to need in my work, in my work life, it really had a huge impact on, and I see it as like a teeny tiny lens that I bring to this work, but kind of through that small pinhole of just a brain injury, for me, at least my increased empathy, my increased understanding, my increased desire to really be an ally when it comes to accessibility. And I feel like that sense of like people wanting to understand and to be allies is increasing. I don't know if that's your experience as well.
Yeah, I hope so. It's I think it's tough because a lot of people, like when I was doing a parasport coordinator, we used to like always recruit volunteers and coaches to help athletes with disabilities and do programs. And it was really hard. And it's really like a good example of becoming an ally. And but like people are just, they struggle when they don't know something. And they kind of tend to shy away from kind of being involved because they don't want to say the wrong thing or make it worse. So I think that's maybe the biggest step forward is like it showing up and like starting to learn. And once they do that and then they become an ally and they start to understand all the challenges and become educated, there'll be a couple mistakes maybe along the way. But if you're trying to do the right thing and you say the wrong thing, it's still okay. Everyone's going to forgive you. Just kind of learn and move on. But I think the education, and we have come so far in this journey to become more accessible so far. So it's only like building that momentum and more people kind of becoming allies.
I think what you're hitting on is like the fear, kind of the fear of the unknown. I think a lot of people are really afraid to make mistakes, which is fair, right? You don't want to offend someone. But also, I guess one of my philosophies in work and life is kind of to fail forward with the idea that, of course, if I make a mistake, I need to apologize for it. I need to learn from it. But when I'm in a position of being an ally, it is all about action. Like you can't just ruminate on it or think about it. It does mean kind of doing something. It's a verb, right?
When that opportunity is there, you got to step up and like do something to help the situation or move it forward.
So what's an example, again, either in your personal or professional life where people have been an ally to you as someone with a physical disability?
Well, immediately, I think when I had my accident, like the whole community of my friends and family and the greater community really helped me out, and they helped raise money, and I was able to get some assisted aids, helped me get like hand controls for a car. And so like all those people stepping up and helping in that time of need is a bit of an ally. And then more so like I work with organizations. And we try to legislate and build like best practices, but it's really like certain people that are champions in this work, and they really step up and they do what's necessary and what's needed. And it's extraordinary when you see it. And then it really makes a big difference in people's lives. So I think of my sports, like the coaches that did kind of show up, and they didn't like have to go in and start a new program for people with disabilities, but they did. And it's not easy because they have to learn, there's so much, and then there's some costs that they have to do. They have to go through the barriers, and then they go through all that, and you finally got a program, and then it's very low turnout sometimes because it's new. And it's when you compare, everything's relative, you compare it to the non-disabled world, you're going to have, say, 20 kids, whereas maybe with the para world, it might be 5. And that can look like not success. So, but it really is, and it only grows year after year. So the allies are the people that stick with it, and they're in it when, you know, it gets a little bumpy, and always positive and cheerful and have that empathy.
Yeah, I love that. I love that description of allies. It's really, really great. The like consistency and the persistence is kind of what I hear you saying, right? That's so it. Like, yeah, really sticking with it, even though you're like, oh, that wasn't so great, or it may not meet our measures of success, or whatever it might be. So we've talked a fair bit about like what are some of the good things happening, both in the public sector, business, you know, impact or nonprofit sector. What are some of the challenges in working toward accessibility in Nova Scotia? And I mean, you bring a wealth of experience from all of those sectors, I think. What do you experience as some of the challenges?
Well, I guess the big thing that jumps out is just to normalize disability. And it's not like this contagious disease that's going to, like, if people step in and start trying to help, that they're going to be whatever affected negatively by it. So the biggest challenge is understanding, like, to comply with all the legislation or what to do next to be a built environment more accessible. Where's the first step? Like, who's the navigator here? You need a shepherd sometimes. If you don't know, you just have no idea. And there's kind of like some stories out there where it's like, oh, we spent $100,000 on a ramp and no one comes. And the hardest part is really getting people to take action, but like realize that if you do a little work, it might cost a little bit more just at the beginning, but it's going to be an investment in a better society, I guess, for lack of a better word. You know, it's chicken and the egg as well. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day who has a building, an apartment building, and he's been doing it for decades. And he's like, yeah, I've never had anyone in a wheelchair ever ask to go. And I'm like, well, have you, like, do you have stairs up front? And he goes, yeah, if we didn't have stairs, do you think I'd get more? I'm like, yes, of course. But it's like just the chicken and the egg. Why would they come and ask for it? And if they never ask for it, he thinks it's not a problem. So it's really starting to like dig into it a little bit. And then another struggle would be, yeah, there are some costs, and that's why we have these programs that pay for 2/3. There's also a little bit on the people with disabilities. They have, with legislation right now, they fought for this legislation and now they got it. And then that's when the real work begins. And it's a lot of showing up and like creating these standards. And it can be a little burnout or fatigue for some people that are showing up, but it's necessary and they continue to do this good work. So those are a couple.
Yeah, I think about that last one because I know some of the requirements for like public sector bodies and others are that to create accessibility committees, and that 30% or more of the folks that are part of the committee have to identify as a person with a disability. And it's come up in many conversations like, oh, the labor for folks with disabilities that then has to, like, it's so great that that's a requirement.
So great, yeah.
And it just means, I mean, you've probably been asked so many times to be on so many committees,
right,
or to represent, you know, like sort of the disability community. It requires people with disabilities to, again, invest time, energy, labor to kind of move this forward, it will have really lasting impacts. But what does that feel like as someone who has been asked?
Well, I was at one time like involved with too many boards, and I burned out. So I had to like put a limit. You know, I'm only going to be on four boards at one time.
Oh, only four. Okay. Okay, Paul.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, you could go out and join a bunch right
yes.
now. So, but it's not easy to make change, I guess. And I think the people that are showing up for these positions and giving that representation, which is so important because everything really starts with like nothing for us without us. Mm-hmm. So they want to be at the table. And really, they have that first person experience, lived experience, which is so valuable because time and time again, I've seen without the representation, they miss the big picture sometimes, and then we're paying to like fix it later with Band-Aids. There's no easy answer. They're starting to pay people more for their time, which is great. And also with Zoom meetings and stuff, it makes it easier to show up at a meeting as well instead of going out in the winter. It's not easy, but it's happening.
I really think, wow, four boards, that's a lot to be on at one time. Okay. I appreciate that. That it's been built in. And really, the accessibility legislation in Nova Scotia was the first time that legislation was co-created with community and government, which again is like essentially all legislation should be built this way, right? So it is amazing that like it's sort of taken accessibility to kind of do things a different way in terms of how laws are enacted in Nova Scotia, who is represented, how are we embedding this in the work of organizations. So I think there's so much to learn from what's happening and how, not just the what, but it's the how too. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's sort of like pluses and minuses to the way it's all being rolled out. But like, imagine if every equity seeking group in the work that's being done kind of with and for, if there was that level of representation. Like, so I just think that is a key part of that, like allyship and what that looks like, the nothing about us without us. If that could be like just, you know, embedded into all kind of equity and inclusion work, imagine what that, you know, just the impacts of that.
Right, exactly. You'd have all the voices represented, and like having the leadership as well to take all this. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, like inclusion, having everyone's different points of views and like trying to move forward with common ground, it can be a little messy sometimes. I don't know if you can ever achieve like 100% inclusion. Like it sounds great, and that's what we want, and if we could do it, we would. But you can really get bogged down. What if we had an instance where it was this? And then all of a sudden, like this great strategy kind of like is stymied. So, you know, they have like, I think I heard the other day, problem solvers and problem stretchers. So, you know, like let's solve this problem. Let's move forward. Let's learn as we go and we'll adjust. But then the problem stretchers just like to stop and talk about, oh, well, this isn't going to work. So I've been on boards that have those as well. And it's it just goes around and around and nothing really happens. So the leadership, get everyone together, and then you would have to have like kind of a strong leader to move forward.
Yeah. So now that you are in public service, do you see leaders who look like you?
Yeah, I think everyone's getting more involved in this work, and they're talking about it. We have committees, and we have goals, and we have timelines. We talk about resources and moving forward, and you have representation. Like I said, I got hired through a designated position, so the government is committed to seeing more people represented in the staff, and so you're seeing that more, and it's becoming more diverse, and really it's awesome place to work because you get to, for like, I've learned more about EDIA, my personal journey, and to see like the government and our staff is all very much involved. We do a lot of work with the community and like righting those wrongs. You're not going to right them, but like you try to accommodate and you know, give equity where it's needed. It starts with the people that are hired, and then they go out in the community and they start doing that work. And that's happening. So it's long, like the disability is just one of many equity seeking groups as well. So, in time, we're always progressing and moving forward.
Yeah. So EDIA.
Equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility.
Yeah, I always have to
all the acronyms. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just I feel like maybe this is your public servant, like, you know, avatar speaking with through acronyms. I'm joking. Only a little bit. But speaking of that, so sometimes what I have experienced is that people focus on the EDI. Mm-hmm. And the A is kind of like either left behind or not included. And it, I don't know, is that, have you experienced that kind of?
Not really. Like, okay. I think they're all different groups looking for more equity, which is a long time coming. And I think there's, when you learn, it's hard to learn about everyone en masse, maybe. And you have to kind of, and that's really the challenge in all this work is understanding each group's or each person's and what's going on. But really where we have to like focus is on the intersectionality of these things. And so if you've got equity seeking groups and there's, you know, they have a disability, maybe they're social economic, they come from non-white backgrounds, like they're going to hit more barriers in society. So that's where we really have to know about the EDIA and how they all mix together.
Yeah, I really like that focus on intersectionality. So like the layers or the barriers then compile as someone maybe with those multiple social identities. I wonder if that's, I mean, that does seem to be more of a thrust of kind of EDIA work as it should be. And I mean, it'll be interesting to see how some of the work sort of shifts and changes as we take more of that intersectional lens. I'm curious, what keeps you going in this work?
Well, I had my accident, and then it almost immediately you see the injustices and all the barriers, and you want to right them. And then you think about the future generations have to go through. And I've always thought like you have to leave things better than you found them. Mm-hmm. So really, my work is to make it better, selfishly for me, but I know it's going to help other people as well. So there's wrongs out there, and they need to be righted or make it more in balance. So that's what drives me.
Nice. And what gives you hope for an accessible future?
Oh, I look at how far we've come, actually. I mean, there's so much, you know, distance to go, no doubt. Like it's, but we really have come a long way. So the built environment, things are just growing. And I look at this legislation, and more provinces are coming, and they're just, you know, sometimes I worry that we talk in silos and we talk to the same people that know about the disability and accessibility, but there's, you know, a huge, huge percentage of the population that doesn't know these things. So really for me, that's the big challenge. It's the people that don't know to have that aha moment and realize that all people matter and that they start looking after each other better. So that's what I really want to see kind of happen. And I think we're becoming better, more sophisticated at understanding, looking at data and ways to accommodate. And that should start spreading and permeating through the general population more. And we'll see that kind of transfer into a more accessible society.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be amazing if like no one had to experience the barriers that, for example, I'm sure you've experienced in the last decades, right?
Like, you see people like that, you know, overcome barriers and succeed, and you're like, wow, that's so great. But like, that is great. And those people are amazing. But like, it shouldn't have to be that they are incredible people to overcome barriers. Mm-hmm. Like, let's make it a little easier for everybody.
Yeah. And kind of like level the playing field and kind of remove the barriers that are in front of many, many people.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. You can learn more at our website, seachangecolab.com. That's seachangecolab.com. I hope you join us for our next conversation